Welcome. You're listening to the Gideon Warrior Radio Network. Look for us on TalkShoe.com. Type in keyword Gideon Warrior Network, and you can find us and other Israelite speakers at ChristianAmericanMinistries.com and AngloIsraelTruth.com. Please remember, your free will gifts and offerings help us to continue laboring in the vineyard. Please consider visiting our support page. We thank you for visiting our network and sites, and it's our prayer you'll be edified by them. Here's the message, and thanks for listening. This is part 7 in America's Constitutional Idolatry. Where we left off in part 6, you recall the Anglo-Saxon law system was indeed that of the biblical Israel. Knowingly or unknowingly, the colonists were on the precipice of trading in those ancient law system principles for a mess of pottage called the Constitution for the United States of America. In short, a theocratic nation-state was about to be converted to a democratic republic with a stroke of a pen, just 150 years after Connecticut's 1639 adoption of the Bible as its constitution. It appeared the framers were eager to implement the three-branch idea of Charles de Montesquieu: legislative, executive, and judiciary. So in this part 7, I'm going to subtitle it The Idol, a Declaration of Worship. Now before I get into my study notes that I prepared for the message, I'd like to take us to 1 Kings chapter 12, and let's begin with verse 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in Mount Ephraim, and dwelt therein, and went out from thence, and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. If this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they shall kill me, and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Whereupon the king took counsel, and made 2 calves of gold, and said unto them, It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set the one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to do worship before the one, even unto Dan. And I'll stop there. So as we see, King Jeroboam made idols. Idols of gold. 2 idols. 2 calves. And in the United States, the colonial charters were about to be supplanted by 2 calves. A Democrat and a Republican. Or, one could say, a declaration and a constitution. Now, I'm certain somebody may quickly retort, well, there wasn't a Democrat and a Republican then. It was the Federalists or the Non-Federalists or the Whigs. And yes, this is true. I'm merely trying to bring to our attention how easily we can be brought into and manipulated into what amounts to a declaration of worship. Framers, Jefferson and Adams and others seem to have been intent on leaving God out of their plans. Adams wrote in his Thoughts on Government, quote, A government cannot long be free, nor ever happy, whose government is one assembly. For a single assembly is liable to all the vices, follies, and frailties of an individual, subject to fits of humor, starts of passion, flights of enthusiasm, partialities, or prejudice, and consequently productive of hasty results and absurd judgments. End quote. Well, what on earth, may I ask, did he think would happen with 3 of them? Actually 4, as he is the proponent of the divided assembly, the Senate and the Congress. There's simply no getting around the fact that with God there is one legislator and tens of thousands of adjudicators ready at a moment's notice to punish the evildoer. And that's a very uncomplicated system, where the vices, follies, and frailties of an individual are met head-on with the laws, statutes, and judgments of God. It was 1779 when Adams got the opportunity to carry out his plan of government as elected member of the convention for drafting a constitution for Massachusetts, later adopted. He says to Benjamin Rush, 1798, quote, I call you to witness that I was the first member of Congress who ventured to come out in public as I did in January 1776, in my thoughts on government, in favor of a government with three branches and an independent judiciary, end quote. Likewise, James Madison in Federalist 47-51 essentially extols the virtues of it and how the checks and balances operates and showers upon de Montesquieu for promoting separation of powers doctrine, which Adams clearly had faith in. In fact, Koch, in The American Enlightened, refers to the letter to Rush and adds this lament from Adams, quote, "Mausoleums, statues, monuments will never be erected to me. Panegyrical romances will never be written, nor flattering orations spoken, which transmit me to posterity in brilliant colors," end quote. I gotta ask, were he alive to see what has become of his three-branch system, he may want to reconsider his desire for credit, as perhaps one day the monuments representing it may be torn down by God, if not first by God's Gideon warriors in America and elsewhere. I want to take a few minutes to bring our attention to some things regarding the Declaration of Independence. I know we touched on it in part of the series, but I've seen a number of writers over the years tell us unequivocally how the Declaration was a monumental expression of our Christian faith and beliefs. And I've since come to learn and even be more aware of the propaganda. If propaganda is an offensive word for you, well, what about brainwashing, or perhaps we could politely call it peddling a doctrine of preconceived notions and ideas? One of those writings came from a 1998 article by Taylor from the National Center for Constitutional Studies. He quotes two authors, Eidsmo and Skousen, briefly. He starts the article conveying a conversation wherein he reminds the person he's speaking to that, quote, "The Declaration of Independence, it speaks of our belief all the way through. That is where you can find a declaration of America's belief in God," end quote. Well, if that's true, then let's go look at them, and by all means, continue to teach and preach it. He said that is where you can find a declaration of America's belief in God. Let's begin by going to the Webster's 1828 dictionary, and let's look up the word declaration, and I quote, "An affirmation, an open expression of facts or opinions, verbal utterances. 2. Expression of facts, opinions, promises, predictions. Definition 3. Public enunciation, proclamation." So, an affirmation or open expression of our belief in God is what he declares this document is and does, that is, the Declaration of Independence. Well, while he concedes that the Declaration does in fact declare our independence from a king, he also declares that it declares our independence from other tyrannical people. But I've read the document dozens of times, and while containing inferences and innuendos, it falls drastically short of a public enunciation of faith or belief in God. So why the continual clamor to make it into something that it is not? And the answer is because more and more Americans are beginning to think and challenge these preconceived notions and beliefs on a surer biblical footing. Taylor writes that Skousen says of Jefferson, quote, "While studying the history of ancient Israel, he," meaning Jefferson, "made a significant discovery. He saw that at one time the Israelites had practiced the earliest and most efficient form of representative government. As long as the Israelite followed their fixed pattern of constitutional principles, they flourished. When they drifted from it, disaster overtook them." Jefferson thereafter referred to this constitutional pattern as the ancient principles, end quote. Now, I don't know about you, but it appears to me this one paragraph is loaded with a bunch of crappy crap crap, or, simply put, propaganda. Let's start with this. As a Christian who tries to diligently study your Bible and ancient Israel, where did you ever learn of their practice of representative government? And don't tell me Deuteronomy chapter 1 or Exodus 18, 20 to 23. These scriptures indicate appointment of heads of families, not anything about representatives, and further, they acted in a capacity of adjudicators to judge matters that were in violation of God's law, to be honest and frank. But I don't want us to lose focus, so stay with me. He says, when the Israelites followed their fixed pattern of constitutional principles, did you catch it? Notice how cleverly this Skousen attempts to push the fat foot of the constitutional stepsister into the slipper of God's divine immutable law system. He then states, quote, Jefferson thereafter referred to this constitutional pattern as the ancient principles, end quote. Again, I ask, what constitutional pattern? Skousen is a doctor of theology. Are you telling me he does not understand the Israelites prospered when obedient to God's laws, statutes, and judgments, and that the curses came upon them in disobedience to those same laws, statutes, and judgments? These are the same Israelites who left the Black Sea region as the lost sheep of Israel, migrating to the isles to the west and north through all Europe. Skousen even says, quote, Jefferson was surprised to find the Anglo-Saxon somehow got a hold of some of these ancient principles and followed a pattern almost identical to that of the Israelites until around the 8th century A.D. Well, shazam! Those rascally Anglo-Saxons somehow got a hold of those ancient principles. If Dr. Skousen and others like him, in fact, nearly all the clergy, would tell the truth about the identity of these biblical Israelites and their commission to be a blessing to the world by following the pattern given by the God of creation and of Jacob Israel, we wouldn't be in this constitutional crisis in America and have spewed this constitutional doctrine all over the world instead of the doctrine of Christ, who is God in the flesh. Now Taylor goes on in the article, quote, the Declaration begins with two paragraphs, followed by a long list of grievances, and then concludes with one paragraph. He goes on and indicates it was a 17-day assignment, and that Jefferson already had written the grievances, so that only required copying. So students have asked, well, why did it take 16 additional days to write those three paragraphs? Here's the answer. Quote, it appears that he spent most of the time trying to structure into the first paragraph some of the ancient principles which he had come to admire, end quote. Now, I want you to keep this in mind now. Taylor writes, quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, end quote. He says, quote, this is a statement of certain facts so obvious, no need for other proof or discussion. Here is the declaration in American law of the simple fundamental belief in a supreme creator, and they said, this is the only basis for sound government, end quote. Well, if this simple statement is a reference to God, Scripture says, thou believes that there is one God? Thou do well. Even demons believe and shudder. What truths are self-evident? The answer is in the full context of the document, that is the Declaration of Independence, is going to thereafter make. You can't intend to impose, imply, or infer that it conveys anything about a truth which he says is a basis for sound government or a basis of our belief in God. He says this is the only basis for sound government. Well, what does that mean? Is it to mean it is because God exists that we should have sound government? But God does exist, and we don't have sound government. These words are nothing more than platitudes. If we believe in a supreme creator, and we are to assume, as has been believed for thousands of years, that the scriptures are the record left for us by his divine inspiration, then why not say so? Why not declare it? The truths that we hold to be self-evident, according to the language of the document, are the things which are to be stated next. Taylor continues, quote, all men are created equal. If we believe in a supreme creator and that he created us, then we must be his children and we must all be brothers and sisters. As such, no one has an inherent right to rule over anyone else. This is a declaration of independence not only from the King of England, but also from our own fellow citizens who might attempt to force control upon us in the form of regulation or licensing. Why should I need to gain my neighbor's permission, or his agent, the government's permission, in order to go into a particular business or occupation? Anytime we set up someone to give permission to another, we have basically said we are unequal. End quote. Taylor, in this article, professes a belief the same as does Obama. Basically saying, well, we can't look at the crime statistics for blacks. We can't have any disproportional, so we all need to be equal. So basically, that's exactly what he did. You remember the one message I did that we spoke of about a local talk radio, reporter, who reported on and titled his report, Blood on the Chalkboard. And what was happening is that the schools were basically being blackballed, if you will, blackmailed by the Obama administration, that any disproportionate truancies and any disproportionate expulsions from school would result in removal of funds or decreased funds. So what I'm trying to express is that Taylor in this article believes the same thing that Obama believes, because Obama believes that we should live up to those famous words in that declaration. We're all equal. Therefore, don't in any way, shape, or form convey that something is happening which is unequal. Taylor goes on to say, this phrase presupposes a self-evident truth, that the Creator made human beings equal in their rights, equal before the bar of justice, and equal in His sight. Well, let's just stop there for a minute. Why did God say that Israel was the apple of His eye? Why did God say that He chose them over any other? Why did God choose them to be a servant nation to the world? Why did God say that they would be a blessing to all the nations of the earth? There is something that is completely skewed with Taylor's understanding of the Bible, and it's the same misunderstanding or understanding, whether it's misunderstanding or not, I question specifically. But it's an understanding that many in the church world have been propagandizing us with for a long, long time. He goes on. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are the three great natural rights of all mankind. An unalienable right is one which was given by the Creator and cannot be taken away by man. If man does violate these rights or take them from us, the offender will surely come under the judgment and the wrath of the Creator, because it interferes with the Creator's plan of happiness for His children. It is interesting to note that the Creator requires government, which is set up to protect man's right, to punish individuals who attempt to take another's rights from him. The punishment always involves one or more of these three unalienable rights: life, which would involve capital punishment; liberty, which would be confinement; or pursuit of happiness, taking property in the form of fines. Because we have combined our resources into communities and states, we have also had to make certain rules for the orderly operation and use of these jointly owned facilities. Well, let's just stop here for a second. Question number one that should come up: how does he come under the wrath of the Creator? Romans 13 clearly conveys how it's supposed to be done, Deuteronomy likewise, and the purpose is so that all will hear and fear and do no more evil. Secondly, he states the Creator requires government. Well, the question here is, if this is true, what is wrong with his government? Thirdly, he says the punishment always involves one or more of three unalienable rights: life, meaning capital. Well, first, he is correct on capital, that is, loss of life, if he understands it correctly. Secondly, he speaks of confinement. Well, I would challenge Taylor and challenge you. Where is confinement in the Bible as a punishment for crime? And thirdly, he says fines. But the Bible doesn't speak of fines. The Bible speaks of restitution to the victim. He says that because we have combined our resources into communities and states, we've also had to make certain rules for the orderly operation and use of these jointly owned facilities, that is, roads, parks, utilities, courts, etc. The rights to use these things are called vested rights because they do not come from the Creator and can be changed by the people. Vested rights are created to protect the three great unalienable rights of the people. Well, vested rights, well, then the community will take ownership and dictate how they can be used. And so why would he complain that the community has said, if you're going to build a house next to this one, then you need to have a permit, and you need to have a licensed individual do this, and a licensed person that we say is actually licensed or authorized. So he clearly does not even understand the things that he himself is espousing in this National Center for Constitutional Studies website. Because that we combine resources to make a park or designate a parcel of ground as a park, and I do not ever intend to use that park, should I and my future children be enslaved or financially burdened to pay for it because I live in the region of this park? The examples are obviously voluminous. He says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their first powers from the consent of the government. Their just powers, rather, not first powers. Their just powers from the consent of the governed. The purpose of the government is to protect the rights of the people. When people join together to hire a policeman or a fireman, they've created government. But where does a policeman get his authority? From the only place where all authority is, from the people themselves. It is interesting to note that there is only authority in individuals, not in groups. Groups are only empowered as individuals come together into groups and delegate to the group some of their authority. Even then, groups of people in cities or states or nations can only do what individuals can do. This is an idea which is seldom understood. Well, good grief. Individuals can get together and murder. Individuals can get together and do all sorts of things that are not biblical. As he says, another part of the ancient principles is that no agency of government has any right to exist except with the consent of the people. But in early America, only freeholders could vote. So people who could not vote had not consented. Why were certain people prevented if that's what was believed? He doesn't even understand that aspect of our history. He goes on, the people have consented to what is written in the Constitution, but where in the Constitution, parenthesis, or the plan of government, end parenthesis, have the people given permission for the hundreds of offices of government which are overwhelming our people? It is true that Congress has created them, but where did Congress get the authority from, the people? We must answer nowhere. End quote. Well, he asked the question as to how we get all these agencies in office and says it's true that Congress creates them, but where did Congress get the authority from? Well, he got it from the people, and the answer is the Constitution, he continues, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is a right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. All right, now let's briefly review that. First, peaceful self-repair. Well, how or why is it repressive in the first place, or constantly in change, that it needs peaceful self-repair? Secondly, he indicates that every two years you get to change every legislator and a third of the Senate, and every 4 years, governors, and the president and a third of the Senate. And then fourthly, he indicates that the framers waited for a majority before taking up arms. Well, that statement is simply not true. They did not wait on a majority before taking up arms. And to the issues of his theory about we get to change every legislator every two years and a third of the Senate, and every 4 years governors and presidents and a third of the Senate. So let's ask Taylor the question. Well, how is that working out? And not only that, you have a judiciary that's been appointed for life. Has he ever considered and contemplated how this would work out if you did, in fact, replace those individuals all of those periods of time, 2 years, 4 years on the cycles, how staffers would be running things? He sums it up and concludes it basically stating this. The acceptance of the Declaration of Independence is an acceptance of God as our King. Well, let's stop there. How so? How does the acceptance of the Declaration of Independence accept God as our King? Because we did not accept God as our King. In fact, the fact is, we did not accept Him as our King. We accepted a Constitution as our King and the people. Nowhere does this Declaration promote that or say that we have accepted God as our King. And nowhere does it even imply that. God does not look for words. He looks for actions. And then he cites Franklin, quote, "Only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters," end quote. Well, doesn't it explain the problem? We the people? The Declaration, you see, fits into this timeline preceding the Constitution, of course. And so the reason I took some time to divert on the Declaration again is because so many have switched their talking points from focusing on the non-biblical nature of the Constitution to the Declaration of Independence itself. As you can now understand, this thinking also is dubiously incapable of attribution being given to it as being representative of the, quote, ancient principles, end quote. This writer represents the thinking of a lot of people, not in exact words, of course, but overall, intending to ascribe to the document biblical ideas or ancient principles and foundations which are really not, or are being manipulated in an attempt to make them applicable, foundational, and as ancient principles. Again, to say these things, to many, they are perceived as casting judgment upon the framers, or trying to make oneself smarter or greater than these great and understanding men, or trying to discredit them altogether. But our focus should rather be on the substance of what is being said and what the fruit of the beliefs concerning these documents. Is it good or has it been bad? Now, one might even respond with, well, the fruits would have been good if we would have just stuck to it. Another one would say, well, the fruits would have been good if we had virtuous leaders. Well, all of those things may sound good, but I submit that sticking to it or having those good leaders is a good part of why the conditions are as they are. So let's let this suffice for now as it pertains to the assertion that the Declaration is the place where we are to find a statement of our beliefs and our profession of God and His laws. We can try to justify ourselves with it, but in the end, we will have to ask, will God justify us? Because what we have is as the same as we did in the days of Jeroboam. We are being given something which is essentially the idol, and a declaration is being made that we shall worship it. And this is exactly what Jeroboam did in 1 Kings. He feared that the Israelites would go to Jerusalem for their annual trip to Jerusalem, and that he would lose control of them. So he needed a way to keep control of them. So he said, here, these be your gods. And in America, we have this constitution which says nothing about God, and we are told, here is your God. This is the declaration of worship. Now, I think we're going to have to stop here on this part of it, because I want to take the Constitution in the historical context of time here and get into the constitutional in the perspective of the timing in history. And if I get into it now, then I'll be combining the two things together and I'll run out of time. So let's stop here for now, and we'll pick it up in Part 8. Once again, I remain thankful for the opportunity to minister unto those of the New Covenant, as Hebrews 8:8 informed us of. This is Doug Nelson, trusting you will hear these words one day. Well done, thou good and faithful servant.